Some time ago, a friend of mine and I were having some discussions, and we were actually having dinner, and we were just talking about some things that friends sometimes talk about in the church, and we were discussing things. Don't ask me how we came up with topics, but we were just saying, if you could invite any Old Testament character — we went from the Old Testament to the New Testament — but if you could invite any Old Testament character to your party, if you were having a party, and by party I just mean church people over and enjoying company and dinner and food and things, and if you were going to invite any Old Testament person to your party, who would you want? And the first thing I said was not Jeremiah. Because even if you watched Dr. Levy's class on Jeremiah, of course, he's called the weeping prophet. And every time he opened his mouth, it just wasn't pleasant. And that's what God gave him to say. He's not who I would invite. But then my thought as far as who I would invite would be King David. I mean, there's a man that could play instruments and sing, and he loved to dance, and he just seemed like a man full of life. And so we went from that topic to various topics, and one of the things that we started discussing is who do you admire? Which character would you say that you really admire? So this particular friend that I was talking to is someone that has done extremely well in business and has worked for large corporations, and so he was saying that he really admires Daniel, and because here is a man who was in a situation — the way he put it was, here's a man who was in the belly of the beast, and yet he was someone that set a wonderful example of no matter what was going on around him, and being high up in the court of the king, still was willing and able to live God's way of life and to set a good example. So here was a man, the way he put it was Daniel in the belly of the beast at that time, of course, in Babylon with King Nebuchadnezzar. And he was a man who was willing and able to live God's way of life and to set a good example in doing so. So in thinking about that in regards to an introduction for today, we recognize that this world all around us is certainly what we refer to as Babylon. And in Revelation, let's go ahead and turn to Revelation chapter 18. I mentioned Jeremiah earlier. This similar thought is mentioned in the book of Jeremiah. You might remember where he is telling Israel to get out of Babylon and to run from her. He says, don't go slowly. You get away from Babylon and you get away quickly. You run from Babylon. And here in Revelation 18, we'll just start in verse 1 where it says, after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily. So it's a very loud voice. It says he cried mightily with a loud voice. And saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. And it's a very, very graphic picture of this end time, how it is before the fall of Babylon. Verse 3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So when we read about this and this fall of Babylon the Great, we recognize it's not talking about the city where Daniel lived, Babylon. It's not talking about that. So the Bible is saying, and we're going to read this here in a moment because I'm going to make an emphasis on this point. The Bible tells us as God's people to come out of Babylon. So with that said, how many of you have been to Babylon? How many of you plan to go to the city of Babylon before Christ returns so that you can come out of Babylon when Christ returns? We don't do that. We don't plan to do that, of course. You don't plan to do that, do you, Perry? Okay. Of course not. So when we recognize it's talking about Babylon, we recognize it's referring to a system, a way of life, the government of this world. And certainly at that time, when it's going to be the beast power that will be in place, there's going to be that system, human system of Babylon inspired by Satan. And we're told very directly then in verse 4 that I heard, where it says, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues." Because we recognize it's saying, look, come out of her. So we understand this biblical principle that as God's people, we are called. And when we are called, we recognize that we are called out of what the Bible refers to, in this case, Babylon. It mentions it directly in other places to come out of Babylon, like I said in Jeremiah. But it's talking about a way of life. We're told to come out of that way of life. That is human beings, humanistic thinking. Human beings will solve human problems. That's what it's referring to, is that ultimate government of human beings controlling human beings. And of course we recognize that it's inspired by the God of this world. So we're told to come out of it. And not just at that time when Christ is going to return and there's that great battle that takes place. But we know that this is something that we do every day. And we are in the belly of the beast. When my friend mentioned that about Daniel, and that he admired that Daniel in Babylon was able to set a good example and live God's way of life, even in the belly of the beast. So when I say that we're in the belly of the beast, I think we understand that we recognize it's all around us. So when we're called out of the world, we don't escape it. We don't go to a commune. Maybe some of you know people in the church that have done that, because I do. When we lived in Colorado a number of years ago, I'd have to work it through my mind, maybe 15 years ago, there was a family who moved to Arizona because a number of families and various church groups have bought a plot of land, and they put trailers on there. I think they each had a half acre or an acre, and they were going to grow various crops and share food, and some were going to have sheep, and some were going to have other things, and they were going to live together there and wait for the return of Christ. Now, I don't see anywhere where that's a good thing to do as we have from Scripture. So when Scripture says, come out of her, my people, we recognize that we are to come out of the world. So we're called out of that, out of what the Bible refers to as Babylon, the world's systems, the world's government, the world's religion, and we're called to be different. We are called to be different. So we're called out of the world, we're told to come out of Babylon, and we're blessed with truth, and we're blessed with understanding, and we're blessed to have true religion and to be called into something. So we come out of Babylon, we come out of the world, and we come into something. And we are called, and I thought this was a really good transition from the hymn that we just sang, we are called to be holy. We're called to be holy. We're called to be different from the world. So when we come out of Babylon, we don't go to a commune in Arizona. And if that sounds good to you right now, just put it out of your head. That's not what we're called to do. We're called to be different. We're called to be God's people. And we are called to be holy. Let's just make that point in 1 Peter chapter 1. So we just sang this, be you holy, for I am holy. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 15 and 16. And you could read a little bit before and after this and see some of the inspiration from that hymn that we were just singing. I always find this interesting in this section of Scripture. I told you I was going to read 15 and 16, and we are. But every time I turn here, I can't help but look at verse 13 where it says, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. That's one of those biblical terms that I always find interesting. How many of you have ever said, let's go to the store, be sure to gird up your loins first. Well, we don't do that, but of course at that time, they wore those long flowing robes like we see sometimes even now in the Middle East. And if they were going somewhere, especially in a hurry, they had to pull it up. So if you remember, which of the prophets, was it Elijah that pulled up he girded his loins and he ran faster than the horses. I can't remember which one it was now, but he got to the city before they did. So this is a section that's saying, do this to your minds, to our minds. As God's people, gird up the loins of your mind. So that what that means is be ready for action in the sense of don't be tripping over things. Don't be stumbling over your clothes. That's the idea. Of course, if you're doing it for your mind, then it's your thoughts. But be sober. Rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Verse 14, as obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts, as in your ignorance. So those are people who are certainly a part of Babylon, who are conforming to their former lusts, to their lusts. They are ignorant, and they are there, and they don't see anything wrong with it. They're happy with it. But God says to his people, verse 15, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Because it is written, be holy for I am holy. So that is what we are called. We're called out of Babylon, out of this ignorance, as it's described here, of living however we want to live. And we're called to live a certain way. We're called out of Babylon, out of the world, to live a certain way and to actually be holy. Now let's turn to Jude. My memory is not as sharp as it used to be, so I cannot remember if I've given a Bible study or sermon on the book of Jude here in York. I know I have in other places, you'll remember this book as far as where he starts writing. He wants to write to God's people, and he wants to write about salvation. Now, salvation is something that should always be encouraging. Salvation literally means to be rescued, to be saved, and to recognize that we have been rescued from death, from the death penalty, and that we have been received, we have been saved and received salvation. Now, it's very, very encouraging. And he says that's what he wanted to write, but he says, look, I have to tell you to fight for the faith that was once delivered, because there's people who have crept into the church, as he puts it, who are false teachers. And these are people who are truly a part of Babylon, a part of this system that's around us. It happened then. It's amazing how early in God's church it happened. But there's other warnings from other writers as well. And Jude is saying these people have come in, and here's what they're doing as far as destroying the faith in some ways. And he goes through these various ways that you can recognize false teachers. And he comes down to verse 11 and he says, woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. So this is just one way that he says, here's how they're living. And of course he says, woe to them. Now, woes are never good. So we see the woes in Revelation, the woes in Matthew 23, and here, of course, he's saying, woe to them. They're going to receive their just reward, is what he's saying when he says that. And he goes through these three attitudes here. They've gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. As I was looking at this, I'm still in the introduction, the lead up to what I want to talk about today. And I thought, well, even this would be a great sermon. You could separate these out into three sermons. What is the way of Cain? And what's the error of Balaam? Now, if somebody were to ask you, based upon this verse, if you just look at this verse and somebody says, what's this error of Balaam? Well, you can see it says he ran greedily. You remember Balaam? We're not going to turn there. I'll do this really quickly. God told him, don't curse the Israelites, because another king wanted him to curse them so that they would. He said, I'll give you a lot of money if you'll just make them cursed. And God said, don't do it. And he's thinking about that money. Man, he wanted that money. And that money, he was thinking about what he would do with that money. First of all, if you remember Balaam, he'd buy himself a new donkey. I'm convinced. He'd get rid of that talking donkey and get one that doesn't do that to him. But he wanted that money. And so he finally figured out an end around, so to speak, to where he could do what that other king wanted him to do and get them to break God's laws so that they would reap the curses of that, and he could get that money for it. So he was greedy. If somebody says, what is this running in the way of Balaam? What does that mean? Well, that's greed. That's being motivated by greed and not worried about what God tells us to do. You're so greedy that you'll do whatever you need to do to get that. And then what about Korah? What did he do? What was his attitude? What was his heart? It's very clear. If you looked at this verse, it tells you he was rebellious. Sometimes for human beings, one of the hardest things in God's church is to recognize that God works with human beings through human beings. And Korah is saying, wait a minute. Moses is a human being. I'm a human being. Why don't I have that office? Why don't people listen to me? And he rebelled against God's servant, the person that God had put in that office. So it says it, the rebellion of Korah. But what about the way of Cain? It says, woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain. So Balaam was rebellious. I'm sorry, was greedy. And Korah was rebellious. But what about the way of Cain? And I want to make this point before I continue, because this is something that we see all around us. If we go to Genesis chapter 4, you'll remember, here's the situation where Abel and Cain were bringing offerings to God. So Adam and Eve, they have a couple of babies, and it says that Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain was a tiller of the ground. In verse 3, so this is Genesis 4 and verse 3, says that in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Verse 4, Abel also brought the firstlings of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering. Verse 5, so this is still talking about the Lord, when it says he, but the Lord did not respect Cain and his offering. And look what happened with Cain. It says that Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. In other words, nobody wanted to be around him. Have you ever been around somebody that's just angry and grumpy and they say bad things and you just don't want to be around them? So that's the way he was in one of those places where he was angry. Who was he angry with? Well, we can assume he was angry with the Lord. The Lord made it clear that he didn't accept his offering. He didn't respect his offering. He was angry with Abel. Abel was, it was obvious that the Lord respected Abel's offering. So we see that he was angry. Verse 7, we know this is a verse and something that I hope that we tell ourselves from time to time. We know God is not a respecter of persons. So this is true for any of us. If you do well, will you not be accepted? This is talking about God. And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. And we know what happened after this. Cain listened and had a change of heart and started to do well and got along with his brother. That's not what happened. He hit his brother in the head and killed him. And of course it goes from one verse to the next that he killed him. We don't know how much time passed, but man, he was angry. Now, he was that angry that his offering wasn't accepted the way Abel's was. And so when we think about this, what was the way of Cain? And if you read this in various commentaries, some of them I thought were somewhat humorous, because they actually, I guess you could figure this out to some degree, or think of this logic. Some of the commentaries, or one of them anyway, said that the way of Cain is the way that he went after he left this area from his family. So he was sent out by himself, and he started cities and all those kind of things, and it caused a lot of problems, and that was the way of Cain. But if you look at this, what the Bible's talking about as far as the way of Cain, when you consider they were taught, they somehow, God taught them how to give offerings and what was expected in offerings. Just like we, as the ministry and the church, teach our congregations and God's people about offerings today. So we tell you, so none of you should be shocked. When I looked around this room, nobody should be shocked that on a holy day we take up an offering. We know that. We've done it for years. Anybody that's been a part of God's church for 10 years, we know this. 5 years, we know it. That's what we do. We don't do it every Sabbath. We do it on the holy days. And we talk about the fact that it's got to come from our heart. God is concerned about the attitude in which we give. So it shouldn't be a surprise that we take up an offering, why we take up offerings. They're commanded, things of this nature. The point I'm making is, it's not that Cain just tried. It's not as if he just brought an offering and went, oh, I wished he would just tell me. I'm bringing these offerings. He doesn't like them. Why doesn't he just tell me? And then he brings another one and it's wrong again. Oh, if he would just tell me, I could do it right. That's not what happened here. He was told how to do it. It's not that Abel just guessed correctly and Cain guessed wrong. They were told, they were instructed on how to do it. Now, there is some debate as to exactly what was wrong with Cain's offering, because some will say he didn't bring the best, that Abel brought the best of his flock. So we're warned about this later in Malachi. You'll remember the people at that time. The priest had gone so far down the wrong way, the people had gone so far down the wrong way, that when they brought an offering to the temple, they would look at their flock and say, you know, this sheep has three legs and one eye, and mucus is constantly coming out of it, and it stinks, and I'm going to take this one to the temple because I can't sell it, I can't eat it, so I'm going to give it as an offering. That's the point they got to. In Malachi, if you remember, it was so bad the prophet was making the point that if you invited guests to your house, you wouldn't even feed them the animals that you're offering. So some people say that Abel gave the best of his flock. It just says he brought the firstlings of his flock and their fat. So some people will say Cain should have brought the first fruits and the best of the fruits, whatever the ground produced, that he was bringing as an offering. And some will say an offering needs blood, and he should have, if he didn't have his own animals, he should have got one from Abel by giving him fruits and vegetables, or however they did it at the time, and should have done an animal offering. It doesn't say. So all of that was just to make the point that in whatever way God taught them, he taught them what was expected in an offering. Abel did it. So when we went through the thread of the Bible, when we started the thread of the Bible, we went through the fact that Abel was called righteous. The Bible calls him righteous. It's interesting. So if you read here in verse or chapter 4, verse 2, Abel is born. In chapter 4, verse 8, Abel is killed. But between that time, those six verses, six or seven verses, Abel lived in such a way that God knew him, and the Bible is later calls him righteous Abel. That's not a mistake. Abel did as God instructed him to do. And bringing this offering, however he was taught, he did it. He did what God told him. This is what I expect when you bring an offering. So Abel did it, and it says that God respected Abel and his offering. Now Cain, who was also taught in how to bring an offering, did it the way he wanted to do it. Now he still brought an offering. He's in his mind, his with his human reasoning, he was able to reason that he was doing everything God had told him to do. But obviously he didn't. God wasn't happy with him, didn't respect his offering, didn't respect him. So when we talk about going the way of Cain, we're talking about doing things how we want to do that, even if we've been instructed in the right way to do it. So we see that Cain, he did it this way. He did it his way. He did it the way that he wanted to do it, and he wanted that to be perfectly acceptable to God. So that's a long introduction in order to introduce that I want to take the rest of the time that I have this morning to review some principles about the Sabbath. So there's the title of the sermon, Principles About the Weekly Sabbath. So we recognize that we are called to come out of the world, out of Babylon, and some of us, if you're in a bigger city, maybe a capital city somewhere around the world, or Paris or D.C. or wherever it might be, we might feel like we're a little bit more in the belly of the beast, but the truth is Babylon is all around us. Human beings living the way of life that they decide for themselves how to live. And as called out people who are called to be holy, we are called to keep the Sabbath holy and to recognize the importance of it. So I understand, I don't think what I say today, the rest of the time that we have, is going to be anything new. But what I want to do, and I strive to do this for myself, and about every year or maybe every other year, shortly after the feast, I like to do a sermon specifically focused on the weekly Sabbath. So we don't forget that even though we enjoy those fall holy days and we enjoy those spring holy days, we have a weekly holy day. It is holy. We're called to be holy. We are called to observe this as holy time, and we have to do it in a way that pleases God, so that God respects us in the way that we are obeying Him, and respects our hearts when we come before Him, and that we don't just come and then the rest of the day we are following the way of Cain, just living however we want to live. So let's review, starting in Exodus chapter 3. If you are keeping up with Mr. Johnson's class on the book of Hebrews, you might remember that I think it was in the second class that he addressed this a little bit, where Moses sees this burning bush. And it's kind of interesting. He recognizes from a distance, we don't know exactly how far. If you've seen the movie Ten Commandments, it looks like it's from a pretty far away, but whatever the distance was, he saw that this bush was on fire and it wasn't being consumed. And it was burning and burning, and the bush just wasn't dying out. And so it caught his attention. And so he wants to check it out. Verse 2, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, but the bush was not consumed. So, verse 3, he wants to go see why. Verse 4, so when the Lord, the Eternal, saw that he turned, that Moses had turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, and he said, here I am. So Moses says, here I am. Verse 5, then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. And he begins to introduce himself to Moses. And we know that Moses was very afraid. He recognized that he was talking to God. in this situation. So we read that it says, "Do not come here, don't draw near to this place until you take your sandals off your feet. And for the place where you stand is holy ground." And as Mr. Johnson was making the point, I want to make that point as well. He was saying, we understand it wasn't the bush that was holy. It wasn't the fire that was holy. Having grown up in God's church, sometimes I'm taken aback or surprised by some things that I hear, primarily in Kenya. I don't hear a lot of this kind of stuff in the U.S., but in Kenya, I have been asked, how can I be baptized by fire? So we know from the Bible, there's a baptism by water. There's a baptism by Holy Spirit. The Bible makes that clear. And there's a baptism by fire. And so there's two of these that you should want. You should want baptism by water. You should want baptism by the Holy Spirit. You should not want baptism by fire. But people equate what happened in Acts chapter 2 when the New Covenant church received God's Spirit and there were flames of fire that they could see. And so people equate that with a baptism by fire. But baptism by fire is referring to the second death, the lake of fire. So when I was asked, how can we be baptized by fire? I'm thinking, why would you say that? So then I have to pause and realize they don't understand. And then I have to go through it and talk about it. But all of that just to say that we know this fire that was burning this bush wasn't a holy fire. And we know the ground wasn't holy ground. In so much that it's not as if you could just bottle up that sand and then put it in your little temple room or something of that nature. That's not what it's talking about. So we recognize, every one of us should recognize that this is saying, I am here. The God was there. So it's God's presence that makes it holy. It's God's presence that makes it holy. So I want to make sure that we understand that God is here at the weekly Sabbath. When we come together as God's people, we come together before our God. So it's something that I want to make sure. I strive to remind myself of this, and it's something that I want to make sure that as brothers and sisters in Christ, we don't lose sight of, that we remember this. When we come together on the Sabbath day, we do so before God. God is with us. God is here. God's Spirit is here. So we recognize that God is here. So what made that holy to where God says, take off your shoes? Well, it's God's presence. And that word holy, it's used in many places. And as we read in 1 Peter, we're told to be holy. And then also in Leviticus, let's turn to Leviticus 11. I don't know if any of you have done this before. Several years ago, I would say probably 25 or 30 years ago, I tried to memorize the Bible by chapters. So if you've ever done that, where you've gotten some chapter cards and various ideas, you know, Genesis 1's easy, creation, but you can go from there to Genesis 6 and Noah and various people and events, and of course Leviticus 11. I had a card for Leviticus 11 for clean and unclean meats. And here in this chapter of clean and unclean meats, come down to verse 43. And we're saying, it goes through all these things about what not to eat. And verse 43, it says, "You shall not make yourselves abominable with any creeping thing that creeps, nor shall you make yourselves unclean with them, unless you be defiled by them." So it's just saying, what are these creeping things that creep, and all these creepy crawlies that we're told don't eat them, You'll make yourself unclean. You'll make yourself defiled. So we can think, certainly, where we live, I was amazed. I never knew this before, how popular crabs were in Maryland. All over Frederick, there's these signs about come and eat crabs, all you can eat for this amount of money. And so there's crabs everywhere. Crabs are creepy, crawly things. You eat them, you become defiled. So maybe some of you have eaten them, and maybe they're good. I've been in a restaurant before, having salmon, by the way, and there's a table of people eating crabs, and they have their bibs on, and they have their mallets, and they have this big mound of crabs, and you can hear them sucking the juice out of the legs and things, and this is the first time I'd ever in my life been around people eating crabs. They smell bad. How do you eat those things? Even if the look doesn't bother you. But so God is going through here and saying, don't eat these things. If you do, if you decide, and remember, all around us, even when people know better, they follow the way of Cain and they do what they want to do. So if you decide to eat this, you're defiling yourself. You're making yourself unclean. Verse 44, for I am the Lord your God, I am the eternal your God. You shall therefore sanctify yourselves, and notice this, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And he goes on to talk about, I am the eternal. I am the Lord who brought you, or who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. So we can certainly put this in our place today. So God brought us up. He called us out of Babylon, out of the world. He says, and I'm the Lord, I'm your God, and you shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. And he goes on to talk about distinguish between the clean and the unclean. So this is just one way that God says, as my people, as my representatives, you are to live this way, and you are to be holy as I am holy. So we recognize that God says, as his people, he expects us to be clean. He expects us not to defile ourselves. He expects us to be holy and to recognize what makes us holy, how we can be holy. So we see over and over in scriptures that God says, be holy, for I am holy. And again, the emphasis that I'm making at this time is that this we come before God on a holy day, and we are to recognize that it's holy, and we're to strive to keep it holy. Notice the importance that is placed on this holiness. Hebrews chapter 12. So leading up to the section of scriptures I want to read, the writer of Hebrews, I noticed going through Ambassador College, we were directly taught that Paul did write the book of Hebrews. So when we studied Hebrews at Ambassador College back in the 80s, they said there's speculation as to who wrote it. Some commentaries will even say Priscilla. I don't know how that comes about, but they have various ideas about who wrote it. We were taught that Paul was the writer. It does not say for certain. And I noticed Mr. Johnson is being careful about saying who wrote it. He does say if Paul wrote it, or because of this, it seems Paul wrote it, and things like that. But whoever wrote it, they're talking about being disciplined, and how you might not like it, but recognize if God disciplines you, it's because he loves you. And parents, as parents, when we discipline, we should do it out of love, not out of anger. I've noticed over and over again how many parents discipline out of anger. They put up with something until they can't put up with it anymore. For some people, it's a short amount of time. So others, it might be a longer amount of time, and then they discipline out of anger. They can't take it anymore. So we're grateful that God doesn't discipline us that way. He loves us. He disciplines us. And it says, because of this, in verse 12, because we should be grateful for it. Therefore, because God loves us, because God chastens us to help us to be more like him, it says, therefore, in verse 12, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. So he's saying here, that recognize, don't get discouraged, don't get down. That's a very human thing to do from time to time, is to think, oh man, can I do anything right? And it seems like whatever might go through a person's mind. So he said, don't get that way. Strengthen the hands which hang down, the feeble knees. Make straight paths for your feet. So what does that mean? Make straight paths for your feet. We should know, anytime the Bible talks about a path, a walk, anything of that nature, it's talking about a way of life. So make good choices. According to God's laws, make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. So whatever is discouraging us, if we make good choices, straight paths for our feet, according to God's laws, not going the way of Cain, doing things how we want to do them, it says there's healing. And then verse 14, pursue peace with all men. Pursue peace with all men and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. There's a couple of things here that are emphasized. Of course, we could talk about pursuing peace, but that's another sermon for another time. Right now, we're talking about pursuing holiness. Recognizing what holiness is, recognizing what makes something holy, and then we pursue it. So one of my goals, I hope nobody is offended by this, but one of my goals in traveling to Kenya is to see animal, preferably a leopard or a lion or a cheetah, pursue something like an antelope and catch it. I've seen them pursue it and not catch it. I've seen them after they've pursued it and caught it, but I didn't get to see that. I just got to see the gory part of the what happens after they pursue it. But the reason I'm telling you that is because you can get a picture in your mind what happens when you pursue something. If you've ever seen a young man that's enamored by a young lady and he's pursuing her, he asks her out, he buys her flowers, he's doing things. If a cheetah is pursuing an antelope, there's action, there's effort that is being made. And so that's the reason I tell you that, so that you can picture in your mind that there's some work that takes place. If you're pursuing something, there's some work and effort that takes place. So it doesn't just happen. Pursue holiness. So we are to pursue holiness. And without it, we won't see the Lord. So it's talking about the return of Christ and the first resurrection. So without this, if we're not doing this, then we won't see the Lord. So we recognize that holiness is important. We should recognize what makes something holy, and we recognize that the Sabbath is holy. So what makes something holy? Let's talk about that for a moment. If you study the words from Hebrew or from Greek, as far as what's translated holy or holiness, they almost all have the same meaning. I'm not going to give you the Hebrew and Greek words. I certainly know I don't do a good job of translating them, but we recognize that they have very similar meanings, whether it's Hebrew or Greek. It literally means something that is separated, something that stands separate or separated, set apart. For example, you and I, if we have God's Spirit dwelling in us, we are saints. How many times in the Bible are you called a Christian? Not many times. I think it's 3. I'd have to look it up to be certain. You can fact check me. There's a man in Clarksville. I won't tell you who it is, but if I say something like that, he'll pull out his phone and he gets on there right then and he'll do something like, yeah, 3 times. So it only says Christian 3 times in the New Covenant, or however many times. It's very few times. How many times are you called saints? Are God's people called saints? Many more times. So we recognize a saint is someone who has God's Spirit dwelling in them. You are the temple of the living God. God dwells in you, lives with you. That makes us holy. It separates us. So do you, DJ, look like every other human being that you look at? Now, I know that some are female, some are male, some you can't tell. they have a head and face and body and hands and arms and legs and feet. So we're like every other human being, but we're called to be different from the other human beings. We're sanctified. We're set apart. Holiness has to do with being sanctified or being set apart. The basic meaning of holy, this is what I want to make sure we understand. The basic meaning of holy, whether translated from Hebrew or from Greek, means separated and set apart. Separated and set apart. So when we think about that, we can understand what makes something holy. The Sabbath day, leading back to this, the holiness of the Sabbath day, when we think about it, recognize that it is set apart from other days. We know this. We understand this. Let's just review it. Exodus chapter 20. So again, if you were memorizing the Bible by chapters, you would know Exodus 20, of course, is the Ten Commandments. And Deuteronomy 5 is the Ten Commandments. So that's a way to be able to find things quickly. Exodus chapter 20. So we have the Sabbath commandments. And it says very clearly, remember the Sabbath day. Exodus 20, verse 8. So we know that this is a commandment. It is commanded. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We are told a couple things here. We're told to remember it. It doesn't say remember any day. So some of you may have been a part of another church group, organization, however we should say it, that believes that you can worship any day. So is that true? Doesn't that sound good? You can worship any day of the week. Is that true? Yes, to the extent that you can pray and worship God any day of the week. But does that mean that any day you can just choose which day to be holy? No, it says remember the Sabbath day. There is a day that is separated from the other days. So we understand that God created this 7-day week, and he separated that seventh day. So he says remember it. We're going to come back to that in a moment, but it says remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord, the Eternal, your God. In it you shall do no work. And it goes on to talk about in this commandment, if you own a business, don't leave your kids at home to earn a profit for you while you go to church. Or it says your servants in that sense today. If you owned a restaurant and you kept it open on the Sabbath so that you could make a profit, he's saying, no, don't do that. You're not going to do things that you would do the other time. So don't do it. So here's one of those things that's very direct. Don't work. And so when we look about Sabbath principles or talk about Sabbath principles, none of us should have this debate on working on the Sabbath. So is it okay? Anywhere in the Bible does it say it's okay if you have to work 30 minutes after sundown on Friday? Or if you have to go in early before sundown on Saturday, as we know it? Is it okay to earn some money somehow? Maybe you're not doing your regular job, but you're on eBay selling things or whatever it could be. None of us should have any doubt about this principle that's very direct. You have 6 days to labor and do your work. So on this seventh day that's separated from the other 6 days, don't do it. For in 6 days, verse 11, for in 6 days, Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. And when it says hallowed it, that's a Hebrew word, has the same root if it was translated holy, like we learned in Leviticus 11. It means God separated this day for a specific purpose. So make sure we understand that. All of this is still in the context of this is a holy day. This is holy time. Every week it is holy time. So anything that is holy, we understand it's set apart from all the other days. Sorry, I didn't mean to put it that way. Anything that is holy is set apart from all the other items that may be similar. So if you're holy, you're set apart from all the other human beings. So they may look like human beings. You can recognize them as human beings, hopefully. But if you're holy, you're set apart from the other human beings. That's a godly principle that we see. Anything that's holy is set apart from items that may be similar. Holiness has to do with something being set apart. And it's set apart for a reason. There is a specific reason for it. And for anything to be holy, God has to be intimately and actively involved. So God has to be intimately and actively involved for anything to be holy. So there's three principles there. Sometimes I realize I'm not the clearest speaker, but I want to make sure that we understand this. There's three principles in holiness that I want to make sure we understand. Number one, for anything to be holy, it is set apart from all other items that could be similar. So I gave you the example of human beings. If you're a holy human being, that separates you from everyone else who is a part of Babylon, who is a part of living the way of Cain and has no problem doing that. And if you are set apart, you're set apart for a reason. God is calling first fruits to live and reign with Christ. So we see a reason for it. And then for anything to be holy, God must be intimately and actively involved. So when we look at ourselves as those who are called out to be holy, as we've read three or four times, be you holy for I am holy, then we're called out, we're set apart. There's a reason for it, and God is involved. And if we apply those 3 points to the Sabbath day, God sets this day apart. It says it here. And of course, if we go back to the creation, you can read it later if you want to, but it makes it very clear that when it says that God rested, it says he blessed that day and he sanctified it. It says that in the creation account. So when he created the Sabbath day, it says he sanctified it. So what does that mean? It means he set it apart. So that seventh day is different than the other 6 days. It's a day of the week, but it's different, and it's set apart for a reason. And God is involved. So God is involved. So let us be sure that we never lose sight that the weekly Sabbath is holy. So God has set apart this weekly Sabbath day for a very special reason. And when we come together before God. So we come together before God. God is here, and this time is holy. And we recognize that God blessed this day. God blessed it and sanctified it. So God made it holy. And so we understand that whatever God makes holy, none of us can make unholy. No human being can. So I mentioned the title of the sermon, Principles of the Weekly Sabbath. So I gave you one. I feel like I'm being fact-checked right here. I've got to look it up. What did I say? I gave you the one the principle that this day is holy, that God has created it and set it apart. And yes, it says he blessed it and sanctified it, and he rested. And so we understand that. So let's think about some more principles. The one thing I wanted to emphasize is the weekly Sabbath is a holy day. It's a weekly holy day. So now that we're past the fall feast and we got a lot of time before the spring feast, let's don't lose sight of the fact that we have 24 hours every week that is holy time. So there's that principle. And then it says, remember the Sabbath day. That's part of the commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So if we're going to keep something holy, we got to follow those same principles where we recognize that we're going to set it apart. We're going to treat it differently than the other days. If we're going to keep the Sabbath holy, we're going to set it apart, we're going to treat it differently than the other days. And we're going to do that for a reason that God has given us. And we're going to recognize that God is involved in it. And we want Him to be involved. And we want to be with Him. So we're going to remember it. And it doesn't mean to wake up and say, wake up on Saturday and say, oh yeah, this is the day we go to church. I am so glad I remembered that. I know you're here, so I don't think any of you do that. I want to make the point when it says remember, it means all week. We remember that there is a day that is separate and different than the other days. So when should we start asking God to bless the weekly Sabbath? So I know I've told you this before probably because I think about it quite often. That many times on Sabbath morning when I'm praying, I strive to always pray that God will bless the services in Bedford and York and Clarksville. That God's Spirit will be here and that no other spirits will be here except God's Holy Spirit. And that God will pour His Spirit out upon His people and the fellowship will be positive and productive and uplifting and all these things. And then I'll pray for Nigeria, and then I'll pray for Kenya, and then I'll realize, wait a minute, services have been done there for hours. Then my mind will think, bless it next week. But the point is, don't wait till Saturday morning to pray for God's blessing upon the Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day. So the Sabbath day is not the day of the week to help you to get organized for the rest of the week. In other words, you get to slow down a bit, catch up on your sleep, think about what you're going to do after sundown and what you need to get done around the house on Sunday. Use the rest of the week to prepare for the Sabbath. Now, society's not set up that way. Babylon is not set up that way. Babylon will run you ragged and make you tired so that all you want to do on Friday night after dinner is sleep. And you think, well, the Bible says the Sabbath is a day of rest. So if services weren't at 10, I could sleep till noon. but that's not how we want to do it. The Bible says, remember the Sabbath day. So understand, I'm talking about another biblical principle or spiritual principle about the weekly Sabbath. Now, use the week to plan to make the most of the weekly Sabbath. So remember the Sabbath day. Don't just remember it on Friday night or Friday afternoon shortly before sundown. Remember it from Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So that we're asking for God's blessing, for God's guidance, so that we're prepared to make the most of this day of the week that God gives us. So we have the fact that the Sabbath is holy, that God is present. We have the principle that we are not to work. What about the ox in the ditch? Let's discuss that for just a moment. Luke chapter 14. Oftentimes in our English vernacular, I know I do this, I don't know that you do this, but I will say ox in a ditch. If you know what a ditch is, a ditch tends to slope down one side and up the other. An ox tends to have decent footing, so an ox can go down and up a ditch pretty easily. The correct translation is pit, ox in the pit. So let me ask you this, because if you understand a pit, it's a big hole. An ox can fall in it and can't get out of it. That's the idea behind this. First of all, how many of you have an ox? Now, in Bedford, Ken Reed raised his hand. He has an ox. He has cattle. He has a bull. So then I said, well, how many of you have had an ox that you own fall in a pit? And of course, he raised his hand. Most of us, though, understand we don't have an ox, and we don't have a big hole in our yard that if we had an ox, it would fall in it. But here we see in this section of scriptures the concept here where Christ, the whole idea behind this is that Christ is healing someone on the Sabbath day. The Pharisees are watching. Luke 14. And Christ is saying in verse 3, at the end of verse 3, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And of course, he did heal the man. The Pharisees kept silent. They weren't going to answer him. So he said in verse 5, then he answered them saying, which of you having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? So that was something they could understand. They were an agrarian society. An ox was something that was very valuable to the work that they were doing, and maybe for feeding their family, whatever it was. So if their ox fell in a pit, even on the Sabbath day, they realized that if they waited till the next day, that ox could be dead, and then it would be of absolutely no value. So they had no problem getting it out of that pit so it would survive. The Jews have done so many things on the Sabbath, as far as traditions of men. You probably are aware of some of the things that they won't do because of work. They view it as working on the Sabbath. When I first started with General Electric in the appliance division, I worked on a 24/7 hotline that people could call in about things, and I never worked on the Sabbath, of course. I said 24/7. I had to work every Sunday because I wouldn't work on Saturdays when I first got hired. But people would call in on Sunday mornings, and they would want to know, or Saturday night, and they'd want to know how to turn the beeping off on their oven. Because for Orthodox Jews, if they use their oven, so they had to use the setting. Some of you do this probably where you can set it up to where I don't know what it's called now. You can preset your oven so that it kicks on at a certain time. It cooks for 2 hours, and then it kicks off. But sometimes if they didn't hit certain buttons, the beeping would go on. So it cooks for the 2 hours, and then it will beep that it was done. And the Orthodox Jews actually could not touch the button to turn the beeping off because that would be work. So GE eventually came up with what they actually called a Jewish setting. And so you literally could turn that button off so that at the end of whatever time you set it to cook up or to cook on the Sabbath, they did all this on Friday and put the food in there so that it would be cooked in time for their dinner. But they could not push the button to turn that beeping off. So they finally did a setting to where they could do that also at the end of it. So the button or the beep, beep, beep didn't go off on the Sabbath, and they didn't have to listen to it all day. Literally, they will pull toilet paper off the roll on Friday because pulling it off the roll, according to some Orthodox Jews, is work. So that's the extreme that they go to. And sometimes when we talk about these biblical principles or principles of the Sabbath, as I'm calling them today, some people will say, well, you're getting caught up in this legalism. Understand, we want to keep the Sabbath as God tells us to. And here, Jesus Christ makes the point, as much as he says, don't work, if there's an emergency, so we don't have an ox, what does an ox in the pit mean? If there's an emergency, what's an emergency? How many of you put on your to-do list, I'm going to have an emergency today? No. If there's an accident or an emergency, you don't plan for it. It happens, and you deal with it. If it happens on the Sabbath and you have to deal with it, then you have to deal with it. But the principle here is nobody plans for their ox to fall in the pit. When it happens, you get the ox out or it dies, and it's of no value. There's nothing left there. So if it's an emergency, a true emergency, or an accident that you have to deal with on the Sabbath, you have to deal with it. But understand that if your ox is falling in the pit every Sabbath, get a new ox. Recognize there's something wrong. Fill the pit, sure. But there's something wrong. If every Sabbath, every other Sabbath, there's an emergency that you have to deal with. But it's it's not saying that if you're going to get fired, go to work on the Sabbath. That's not an ox in the ditch. That's a matter of faith. That's a matter of making a straight path for our feet, choosing to obey God, making good choices. So, yes, there's the principle of the ox in the ditch, but understand what an, or a pit, understand what an ox is, understand what the pit is. So we see this principle of the Sabbath day. There's now I'm going to rush through this because I've already gone over time. But appearance, there is absolutely no problem that I have ever seen in this congregation. But I just want to say this: the biblical principle. Now, why do we wear ties to church if you're a man? No matter what style of tie it is. Where did ties come from? So I've read before, I don't know if this is true, that royalty in England would wear them because they were tired of always looking for something to wipe their mouth with after eating. So they would eat and they would wipe their mouth clean. So I don't know if that's true, but that's one idea of the origin of ties. Why do we wear, where's the scripture that says all men must wear coat and tie to services? We know there's not one. The principle, whether you're a man or woman, male or female, is to wear your best before God. God is here. We come before God. We wear our best. So thank you all for doing a good job as far as setting a good example in that regard. But in that principle, I just wanted to touch base on it because in some areas it is a problem where people dressed in an inappropriate way, the way of Cain, in a way that might draw attention to their body or whatever it is. But when we come before God, we wear our best. We dress appropriately for services. And then just quickly again, touching upon the idea of the Sabbath rest. So if you're ever wondering what's good to do on the Sabbath or what's not good to do, I want to make just a couple comments about this. Number one, I mentioned about some people with the Pharisees and saying that we're becoming legalistic or this or that. So some people say you're just too, I'm making a generalization, you're too strict on the Sabbath about what you can or can't do. So let me emphasize that I would like to encourage myself and all of you to be zealous for the Sabbath, to be zealous for the Sabbath, to remember it, to keep it holy. And in any regards to God's law and God's way of life, remember this, there's a saying that human beings use sometimes that it's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is to ask for permission. Don't apply that to God's way of life. I would encourage us to err on the side of going above and beyond in obedience to God, not seeing just how close we can get to the line or what happens if I cross the line. Go above and beyond in obedience to God. That's a good principle that we should base our life on in regards to the Sabbath. So what do we do in that regard? Be zealous for the Sabbath. Recognize that what we can do the other 6 days of the week, work shouldn't even be an issue. It says don't work. But what about chores around the house? The principle is don't do anything that's not necessary, unnecessary chores. It's not necessary for any of us to mow the lawn on the Sabbath. I know that's it should be an extreme example. But you have to apply this according to your life. None of us should be doing unnecessary chores on the Sabbath. What about buying and selling? There are always areas that might be okay for one family that's not okay for another family, because I know people who will not eat out on the Sabbath. It bothers their conscience. Now, I know people who have studied it and have no problems doing that. As a church, we teach the Bible is not against eating out on the Sabbath. That's come up over and over again. But if it bothers your conscience, there's the spiritual principle. Don't do it. You don't have to judge others, but if it bothers your conscience, don't do it. And I'm talking about anything. Personally, I strive to make sure I always have a full tank of gas on Friday. I see no reason for any of us to get gas on the Sabbath. So unless this has happened before, I've driven so far between congregations that I either had to, on my way home, pull over and wait for sundown to go to a gas station or fill up to get to the next service or whatever it might be. I've driven that many miles before. But we can make the effort. So if we remember the Sabbath day, that's part of remembering the Sabbath day during the week. We can make the effort to fill up our tank. Now, what about ice cream? The only reason I say that is occasionally when our kids were young, after dinner on Friday, we would take them out for an ice cream cone. That didn't bother us. Some people don't want to do that. That's a choice that if it bothers your conscience, don't do it. What if you just didn't have the kind of ice cream you wanted at home and you went to the grocery store and got ice cream and bananas and chocolate syrup and nuts and cherries and whipped cream? That might be going a little overboard as far as the shopping on the Sabbath. So the principles are, again, as far as what it is, if you can do it 6 days of the week, God gives us 6 days to make our living, to enjoy our lives in that sense of hobbies. I know people in the church that love to fish. They'll fish 6 days of the week, and then they'll say, I'm out in nature worshiping God, and it doesn't bother my conscience to fish on the Sabbath. I'm thinking that's crossing a line. Personally, I'm just telling you that. Where do you draw the line? What about somebody who likes to golf? What about somebody who likes to fix motorcycles? It relaxes me, and I recognize the God-given ability of man to create these engines on the Sabbath. And so, if you can do it 6 days of the week, the Sabbath then is a separate day. And is it wrong to teach our children? I guess I'm talking to DJ here. you can't do this on the Sabbath. Because sometimes I hear, well, the Sabbath is so negative. You can't do this. You can't do that. Well, how does God teach us? So are we God's children? Yes. What do the last six commandments start with, to one variation or another? Wait a minute. The fifth one is honor your parents. So forget that one. Number six. Number seven, number eight, number nine, number ten, do not lie, do not commit adultery, do not steal. It's okay to be taught by saying, don't do this. So even on the Sabbath, we might have to remind ourselves, since our only child here is DJ, but I know some parents who say they don't like to tell their kids, no, don't do this on the Sabbath. They redirect them, or even through the week. People don't like to teach no today. And it's even in the church, some parents don't like to teach no. It's okay to understand that sometimes no is the right answer. So what about music? That's another thing that comes up. So if we apply the principle, if you listen to Hank Williams 6 days of the week, is Hank Williams Sabbath music? I always find myself when I say that, making mention that if you don't listen to Hank Williams 6 days of the week, it's still not Sabbath music. But I hope you get the principle that for us in our house, I like music, and we listen to music at home. But on the Sabbath day, I like a lot of classical music, so I listen to it during the week and on the Sabbath. But the point is, there's music that will help us observe the Sabbath in a way that's holy and right before God, and there's music that takes away from it. So we're talking about general principles of the Sabbath. The Sabbath is a day of rest. Did God need to rest? No. He said, I'm creating this day by stopping all the work I've done before. So what you do this 6 days of the week, we don't do generally on the Sabbath. So these are basic principles, and I gave the sermon in Bedford and Clarksville, and I wanted to give the sermon here, and I'm going to end in Hebrews chapter 10. We are told in verse 24, let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more, as you see the day approaching." So there's two ideas here as far as this exhorting one another, stirring one another up in love and good works as the day approaches, as the seventh day approaches. If you have time, you can make the effort, touch base with those who have been sick or ill, someone you know that might need a ride to church, whatever it might be. Call one another, encourage one another, talk about being together at services, and certainly as the day approaches as far as the return of Jesus Christ. There may be a time in the future, who knows what the future holds. The Babylon is all around us, and it seems to be getting stronger and stronger. Who knows how much longer we can meet in peace? Who knows how much longer we have to where we can come together on the weekly Sabbath. We're very blessed right now. We can meet in peace, and we have a beautiful place, a hall that we can meet in and come together. But, brethren, every one of us knows somebody who, for whatever be the reason, whether they're in their living room listening to sermons or going to nowhere or whatever it might be, who has forsaken the assembling of ourselves together. And it's a wonderful blessing. God has given us a weekly holy day. So let's recognize how holy and precious it is and make the most of it each and every week.